Do you ever see somebody cite their own moral clarity as justification for treating others horrendously? It's the Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Kate Archer-Kent, and we get to spend this next hour checking our ethics, contemplating how we contemplate, the decisions that we make, and the consequences they create. What should we be considering before we begin taking action? We're spending this hour investigating the right and wrong of it all with an expert in ethics, and we want to hear from you at 1-800-642-1234. Email always ideas@wpr.org. If you have a moral quandary, we've got the guest to help work your way through it. Rick Kite is the director of the D.B. Reinhardt Institute for Ethics and Leadership at Viterbo University in La Crosse. He's also the host of the Ethical Life podcast. Rick, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Good morning. Good to be here.
So just let's start with a little simple definition. I think we all have our own idea of ethics, but as the expert, how would you define it?
Well, really two major ways that we tend to use the word right now in our society. One is for kind of accepted kinds of behaviors in society. So this is sometimes what we call social norms. So what is right or wrong as commonly regarded in social settings, public settings, that sort of thing. And the other is the academic study of right and wrong or good or bad behavior.
The academic study. I guess I think in more terms, most would think more in more terms of social norms. But how does the academic study look at how we see our right and wrong of it all, Rick?
Well, in the academic study, one of the things that we pay attention to is that we're really not very good judges of our own character. We tend to be extraordinarily biased when it comes to our own interests. And so with the academic study, we say, okay, what are the basic principles we have to use to go back in cases of uncertainty or where we're, say, pulled different directions because competing expectations, what we often call a moral dilemma or an ethical dilemma, like what are the principles we use to decide one path from another? Or what do we use to try to get some clarity where we might have some bias pressing against us? So that's when we refer to theories like utilitarianism or deontology or virtue ethics. So that's what we do in the academic study of it, say, okay, there's some basic principles or guidelines that can help us get clarity when our, like the ways in which we've been raised or our social expectations aren't very reliable guidance.
And then the other aspect of that is social norms. And as you talk about ethics and social norms, the first thing I jump to is what I'm supposed to be doing in this pandemic, how I'm supposed to be acting, what I'm supposed to be wearing, trying to follow the health advice and how it changes and whether or not I should change with it or steadfast to my own, I guess, biases. As the director of ethics and leadership at Viterbo University, Rick, how have you waded through this pandemic and the social norms of it all?
Well, this has been for an academic, it's been a very interesting time. But personally, it's very confusing because our society is changing very rapidly because of the development of new technologies. And that always presents a challenge for anybody living in a time where there's these really rapid changes. So, for example, how do you raise kids in the era of smartphones and social media? This is like, because it's not the same way we were raised. And so that puts a lot of pressure on social norms because we have suddenly no idea what to expect or what's right. And then the pandemic puts another layer of pressure because now you've got all this pressure from, people about masking and vaccination and so forth. And we really don't have a tradition to rely upon. And in the absence of any kind of tradition or accepted ways of behavior, then kind of immediate social pressure from our peers becomes really significant. And then social media ramps that up because it extends that circle of like, who are our peers? Who is looking at us and making judgments about us? So it's a fascinating time to study ethics. It's a really confusing time to live.
Yeah. Are the ethics murkier now than they have been in the past? Has technology made ethics more of a moral quandary itself?
Yeah. Whenever we have any development of new technology that significantly changes our lives or the ways in which we interact, that presents challenges. So, for example, You know, you have the Kiernan and Quinlan case from the 1970s that really initiates the start of medical ethics as a discipline, because we're suddenly presented with the ability to keep somebody alive on machines. When, you know, before in human, every case like that in human history, a person would have died naturally, and now we can keep them alive artificially. Well, that presents a challenge. So what should we do in those cases? And now with social media, I think it's just kind of the latest development in technology. I mean, we tend to value very highly the principle of free speech. And yet, what if the kind of speech that's enabled by social media is really damaging to our democracy? What should we do in that kind of case? And it presents a kind of a fundamental conflict of our values.
And so how do I, as just somebody who's taking it all in, begin to assess how I'm supposed to adapt, what my social norms should be? Because as you started, Rick, it sounds like I'm not a great judge if I've got all these biases, and then all of a sudden I've got new technologies that seem to be reinforcing my biases, which would make finding my maybe a moral compass a little more difficult to go by. So if I'm trying to find my first step forward, what am I supposed to think about? And we'll use the pandemic as an example, to mask or not to mask. Would I go wear the mask today or not?
Yeah, well, I go back to kind of the foundation of ethics in Socrates, who believed that the moral wisdom really begins with questioning, acknowledging that we know much less than we think we do. And so if we're going to develop some wisdom in areas of uncertainty, the first thing we do is we ask sincere questions. We engage in real dialogue with one another. And our kind of our natural tendency is to form an opinion and then to try to find reasons to back it up. And so what we want to do is reverse that and say, okay, like I really don't know as much about masking as I think I do. I know what my friends think. I know what different experts say, but like what's really going on in these cases? And I'll give you an example, you know, like the masking advice from many of the experts has changed quite a bit over the course of the last 2 years.
Right.
And yet a lot of people's opinions have not changed over the course of that time. They formed their opinions at the beginning of the pandemic and have persisted with that. And so that's an area where you have to have a little bit of humility and say, okay, what's really going on? What's best in this setting?
Best for whom might be the question. Our guest is Rick Kite. He's the director of the D.B. Reinhardt Institute for Ethics and Leadership at Turbo University in La Crosse, also the host of the Ethical Life podcast. And we invite you to join us. If you have any ethical decisions you're facing today, we could help wade through it. And step one, ask some sincere questions. Do you find it easy to do what you think is right in the complicated situations? Do you agonize over your decisions even after you've made them? Join us at 1-800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. So as I'm going through my day, I don't necessarily think of ethics, Rick, but this morning it's front and center. Why should ethics matter when I'm just trying to get through my day?
Well, you might not think about it, but you're making dozens, perhaps hundreds of ethical choices every day. And most of them are not like fully conscious deliberative decisions, but you're making all kinds of small decisions like, you know, will you drink coffee or not? What kind of coffee? Where is it sourced? What you're going to eat for breakfast? Who you're going to talk to when you drive to work? I mean, how are you going to let somebody in who's got to turn in on the turn signal trying to get into the lane ahead of you? Or are you going to pull up and keep them off out of that lane? You know, we make these decisions constantly. And for the most part, that works just fine. We have pretty reliable kind of habits. Most people are fairly courteous and polite, and we get along just fine with one another. But every once in a while, there's times that come up where some stress is put on our relationships or our well-being. And that's when we have to get more deliberative. And so we should be paying attention to it, first of all, because we are making ethical decisions continually. And then occasionally we have to make really serious ones with profound impacts on our lives and the lives of others.
Rick Kite, our guest for the hour as we tackle ethics. He is the director of the Institute for Ethics and Leadership at Viterbo University, also the host of the Ethical Life podcast. And your ethical questions when we continue at 1-800-642-1234. I'm Lee Rayburn, and you're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. You ever see somebody so righteous in their own beliefs that you wonder how it's possible they can go about things so wrong? Now, do you ever wonder if others sometimes see you that same way? Oh, it's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm Lee Rayburn, and I do. So we're putting together a plan for gathering the right information in order to make the right decisions in ways that can benefit ourselves and others, knowing full well that it ain't easy. So please pose your impossible questions to our guest and let's work our way through the best paths to take. 1-800-642-1234 to join our guest, Rick Kite, who is the director of the D.B. Reinhardt Institute for Ethics and Leadership at Viterbo University in La Crosse, also the host of the Ethical Life podcast. Let's go to Chris in Port Wing. Chris, good morning. You're on with Rick Kite.
Good morning. Good topic. I'm with the Syndicate for the Ethical Applications of Technology, and we're investigating a book right now, new book called The Age of AI and Our Human Future. One of the authors was Henry Kissinger. The book looks into how machine learning and artificial intelligence are being handed over a lot of our decision-making, and this is a very important ethical question, especially when it comes to modern weaponry. So as we move into this artificially intelligent machine learning kind of control system, we have to challenge ourselves to see if we're willing to give up the ethical decisions that underpin the kind of decisions these machines are making. It's happening right now. This book, The Age of AI and Our Human Future, really outlines really well how this is happening, and we should all look into it because it's going to affect our ethical future forever.
So Chris, what do you think about letting AI make the decisions, especially since as we started our conversation with Rick, he said we're not the best at making decisions sometimes.
Well, I think as individuals, Rick's right. But if we look at the ability of the culture to collectively make moral decisions, we start to get a more refined result and better results. I think the idea that, let's just take a typical example from the book. Let's say you're running a weaponized drone with algorithms, which currently we do, but there are human controllers that make the final shooting decisions. Now, whether you kill an enemy or not is dependent on lots of factors, and the human brain is able to analyze multiple factors all the time and you know, very, very different levels of cognition. AI is very specifically assigned to tasks and efficiencies. And the thing that people like about it is that it brings in efficiencies. But I'd like to suggest that leaving ethical decisions like whether we kill somebody or not to a machine is fraught with all sorts of problems. And we need to look at how we want to judge our important decisions in a time when the machines are, you know, the machines come with a bias.
Biases come from the programmers. And let's turn it to Rick here and see what he thinks about the age of AI and our human future. Rick?
Yeah, I'm actually quite worried about this for a number of reasons. One is that, you know, with the bias that goes into the programming comes from what we can anticipate, and the future's much more uncertain, varied, and complex than we can imagine. And so when we put all kinds of power into any kind of program to make decisions for us in the future based on what we can anticipate right now, we invariably get it wrong. And so, and you know, when we're talking about weapons and things, we're putting a vast amount of power into something that then is out of our control. The other thing is the effect of putting more and more decision-making responsibility and more power in the hands of of computers in general, because we're starting to see already how that affects social trust. Because social trust develops out of our mutual dependency on one another, and oftentimes trust works its way out of disagreements that we have when we have disagreements, but then we resolve them. So this idea of like our collective decision-making tends to be better than individual decision-making, that's absolutely right. But out of that collective decision-making, the experience we have over our lifetimes is that we begin to trust one another even more. But when the decision is made by others, and so we're not participants in it, we don't develop that trust. And we're really seeing the effects of that on our democracy now, right now, and AI is going to make that even worse.
Very much appreciate the perspective, Chris. Thank you for the call. Let's go now to Sue in Verona. Sue, you're on with Rick Kite, the Director of Ethics and Leadership at Viterbo University.
Yes, thank you for taking my call. Yeah, just as an aside here with the previous caller, with smart technology, there is an overemphasis, I think, on efficiency and optimization, and a lot of times that masks what really are value or political judgments that should be dealt with explicitly. But my original reason for calling had to do with the hearings that arose out of the hearings with the Supreme Court nominee, because they were talking about substantive due process and how you reconcile freedom of religion with other liberties. And I'm just wondering if of course, this is an issue that comes up outside of a judicial context too, but how we reconcile, religious freedom and beliefs with the liberties of others, particularly, I think we were talking about the definitions of marriage and where those conflicts arise and how we can resolve them.
Sue, I appreciate that very much, and the perspective of, the role that religion has played, faith has played in our own ethics in the past, and how that now applies to our present, Rick.
Yeah, I mean, religions are one of the primary ways in which cultures historically have passed along their values, like what they think are most important to the next generation. We're living through an age right now where many Western democracies are seeing significant declines in religion, but also real challenges in kind of identifying what do we believe in common. Mm-hmm. And that puts all kinds of stress on our society. And I think we see it on particular issues that come before the Supreme Court, say with religious freedom, but it's not just that, like these issues of due process, for example, which our caller mentioned, point out a real conflict we have in our politics between means and ends. That most of us, when we think of like whether we are conservative or liberal and what issues we support, we're talking about the ends, what kind of results we want to see. And yet, we have all kinds of, we have ethical guidelines for politicians that we want them to abide. These are all about process, about like fair procedure and so forth. And then we have Supreme Court justices who are really supposed to deliberate primarily on issues of laws and constitutional principles that set out kind of the rules that we live by, not the ends that we achieve, but the rules we agree to live by. And that puts a lot of strain. I think we as a society, we're becoming more and more consequentialist. We're talking more and more about what we want to have happen and less about how we want to live together. And we see that kind of conflict come out in these hearings with Supreme Court nominees.
And over the last couple of days, but there's also the element of technology that plays a role in this too. As Senator Cruz from the Judiciary Committee was, according to an LA Times photographer, searching his own name on Twitter yesterday from the dais during the hearings to find out what the reaction was. That there is this confirmation bias, reinforcement that people are looking for when it comes to their opinions, and they can find it with the click of a button now, and that does not seem to be something that has been available, at least in the past.
Right, and more and more of the congressional staff are really publicists rather than, like traditionally it used to be, people that were helping to write and research laws.
people that were helping with the means to get to the ends that we all purport to support.
Exactly. And now they're really, you know,
hired
to do more of the just getting elected, which, you know, this is unfortunate because I think in a democracy, like how we identify like who we are is primarily about the means by which we live together. And that's.
Who are we? Yeah, who are we? Are we what we think in our own head, or are we the way others see us? And that is a question to pose, especially since we're spending the hour on ethics with our guest, Rick Keight, the director of the Institute for Ethics and Leadership at Viterbo University. And your calls at 1-800-642-1234 about the moral dilemmas that you see. Up next is the news. Then we'll continue our conversation and hear from you. I'm Lee Rayburn, and this is The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. You know, sometimes it feels like there are simply no good choices to be had. What are you supposed to do then? It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Kate Archer-Kent. And take, for example, the thought experiment known as the trolley problem, explained here by the NBC sitcom The Good Place.
Michael, what did you do?
I made the trolley problem real so we could see how the ethics would actually play out. There are five workers on this track and one over there. Here are the levers to switch the tracks. Make a choice.
The thing is, I mean, ethically speaking...
No time, dude! Make a decision!
Well, it's tricky! I mean, on the one hand, if you ascribe to a purely utilitarian worldview...
Okay. So, what did we learn?
Nah, ethically speaking, what do you choose? And isn't not choosing still a choice? Join our conversation about the right and wrong of it all. Our ethics at 1-800-642-1234 or email us ideas@wpr.org. Our guest for the hour is Rick Keight, the director of the D.B. Reinhardt Institute for Ethics and Leadership at Viterbo University in La Crosse. He's also the host of the Ethical Life podcast. And we'll go back to your calls this morning where Jim's standing by in Newport Township, Illinois. Good morning, Jim.
Yes, good morning. And the observation I want to share is kind of a continuation of the subject that we were on before the news capsule. When I was in high school, I had an instructor in U.S. history that made quite an impression on me in many ways, but he stated that before a person should form an opinion, they should collect as many facts as possible before doing so. Unfortunately, I think that's exceptional right now in our culture, that people seem to form an opinion convenient to their emotions and then go out and seek a edited collection of facts, which is so easy to do today between the nature of cable television as well as a website of choice.
It's Jim, you make a great point. It seems like no matter what my bias might be, there would be a place in the media or in technology to confirm my bias or at least support it. Rick, I ask you what you think of Jim's takes on, while it may be easy to collect some facts to draw a conclusion, collecting all the facts seems almost impossible.
Yeah, it does. In some ways, I mean, we're living in a time now with information availability where it's easier to get at the truth than ever before because there's so much information, but we have to work harder to get it, I think. And I wish we spent more time both in our high schools and universities teaching media literacy. That is like, because so much of our perception of the world, what we take in and count as reliable comes from the people we associate with. And kind of generally speaking, that includes the media we consume. So who we listen to, what we read. And I think it's very important to get our information from a variety of sources. So I've subscribed to, you know, newspapers that are regarded as both liberal and conservative. I listen to different radio stations and watch a little bit of some TV programs. But I think it's dangerous to rely too much on one source or a source like from one side of the political spectrum, because we begin to lose perspective, and that becomes pretty easy to do right now.
Rick, I have an email here from Tony, and Tony's from Madison, works with high school students there, and said that making ethical decisions takes practice. And Tony works with these students on making good decisions and figuring out the difference between the good and bad choices to be had. It is not something that usually comes naturally to everyone, Rick says, or Tony says. And he wants to know, can you talk about how we can improve over time on making more ethically sound decisions? Where's the room to grow?
Well, the room to grow is in you're right, practice. We're very sophisticated moral or ethical reasoners in one respect. I mean, from the time that we learn the language, we learn how to think in terms of like distinguishing true from false. We learn to anticipate future events and evaluate the consequences, like what will happen if we do this or that. We learn like rules of fairness, like thinking, like, how would I feel if somebody did that to me? That's what psychologists call reversibility. Or the question, like, what if everybody did that? These are kind of general ways of thinking about fairness. And then character, you know, like, nobody wants to be a bully, or you should be kind or polite or generous. We learn these. So the kind of four ways of thinking in terms of truth, consequences, fairness, and character, we learn them all from a young age, and we get lots of practice at them. What we don't get much practice at is stepping back and saying, okay, I'm approaching this situation. Am I only using the one way of thinking that most benefits me or the outcome that I want to see? And this is where we need practice to say, okay, I need to slow down and use all these different ways of thinking, because it's very likely that the people I'm talking to are using another way of thinking that they're also very good at. And this is where I think a lot of misunderstandings arise. So we are very good, very skilled and sophisticated at using each of the ways of reasoning. What we're not very good at is stepping back and trying to use them together when some of the ways of thinking don't turn out to be advantageous for our interests.
Sometimes I feel myself reacting, and after I'm done reacting, I realize it's probably not the best action I could take. Whereas if I had taken a moment to pause to consider before I took action, as opposed to just reacting to something, often I find the consequences are better for everybody.
Yeah. And kind of knowing when to slow down and reflect and when you don't need to, that's a real judgment call.
Oof. Yeah, take some practice. Rick Kite is our guest, the director of the D.B. Reinhardt Institute for Ethics and Leadership at Viterbo University, the host of the Ethical Life podcast, and your questions for him at 1-800-642-1234. What are some of the ethical concerns or questions you have about current events, like the Russian invasion of Ukraine, protests for social justice, the pandemic? How do you think children should be taught about ethics? Let us know, 1-800-642-1234, or email ideas at WPR.org. Let's go to Elaine in Middleton. Elaine, you're on with Rick Kite.
Yeah, thank you. You know, the one thing that's really become kind of fashionable, I don't know if this is since the Second World War or whatever, but is cost-benefit analysis, which is closely linked with probability in terms of, you know, anticipating the effects of one action or another. And I think what I hear a lot of people expressing sort of unconsciously is a kind of social Darwinism. You know, there's some costs, there's some risks that we're willing to accept, you know, and if it's only like a small percentage of the population, or we don't really know exactly what the costs are going to be, well, we're not going to worry about it. And it's kind of like a survival of the fittest. And I'm just wondering if that, you know, that cuts across a lot of ethical principles, but I'm just wondering what the guest might have to say about that.
Elaine, thank you. Rick?
Yeah, that's really interesting, and I think absolutely right. For one thing, like scientific thinking in general lends itself to that way of ethical reasoning in terms of like what are the effects of the different decisions we could take, and the effects tend to be either positive or negative. So we categorize them as costs and benefits. And as we become a more scientifically advanced society, that way of ethical thinking has become more dominant. And where bias tends to enter in is we oftentimes don't, I would say, we don't take time to think about realistically about who all the people are who are affected by something. So we weight the costs and benefits for ourselves and those we identify with much more heavily than the costs and benefits of others who we maybe aren't aware of or we don't identify with as closely. And so that's where a real bias can enter into it. But so to do a cost-benefit analysis responsibly requires, first of all, asking, like, who are all the people that are affected by a potential decision? And then kind of systematically going through and saying, okay, so for all of these different groups that are affected, what are the costs and what are the benefits for each one of them? And then try to compare them realistically to one another. And that actually takes some time to do. And I think very often it results in very good decisions, especially regarding social policy, you know, where we're trying to make decisions that affect a lot of different people in different ways.
To go back to the trolley problem, you've got five people on one track, one person on another track. That decision may seem morally clear if you have to make a choice. But what if that's one person that you know all too well on that one track and five people that you've never heard from and would never hear from again on the other track? And that sort of thinking could lead us into some, I would imagine, moral gray area. But considering who all the people are affected could also be challenging in terms of my own empathy, Rick, and how I can just cope with my decisions.
Right. Yeah. And it's, that's such a great case. It was developed by Philip Afoot kind of in the middle of the 20th century as a way of kind of illustrating the dilemmas we fall into with some of these contemporary ways of thinking, including utilitarianism, which is a cost-benefit analysis. And it seems pretty straightforward. If it's a choice between killing one person or killing five, I should obviously kill one. But if that means that I have to take action where I'm actually responsible for the person getting killed, that, like, my guilt comes into play because then I become the agent of the action. Whereas if, you know, the trolley just continues on its track and kills the five and I do nothing, then I don't feel responsible. I think, like, that's a really bad outcome, but I didn't do it. And it just points out the way in which, like, we have conflicting kind of ways of thinking through our moral or ethical responsibilities, and the ways that we use to navigate everyday life, which have a lot to do with emotions like empathy, our fellow feeling for one another, and, you know, potential guilt for decisions, aren't always reliable when it comes to developing broader based policies where we have to take a more distant stance.
Our guest, Rick Kite. He is the director of the D.B. Reinhardt Institute for Ethics and Leadership at Viterbo University. He's also the host of the Ethical Life podcast, and there is still time for you to join us at 1-800-642-1234 over the phone or email ideas at WPR.org, and we will get to your questions about our ethics when we continue. I'm Lee Rayburn, and this is The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. We are all, every one of us, storytellers in our own right. And in those stories that we tell ourselves, we never see ourselves as the villain. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm Lee Rayburn, and each of us are the protagonists in our own internal dialogue. So how is it, then, that our actions can sometimes leave us feeling like we are the absolute worst antagonist? Well, we're working on making better decisions, fostering better outcomes, and maybe, just maybe, leading towards a more fulfilling life. In this ever-complicated world, how are we supposed to do the right thing? There's still time for you to tell me and ask our guest at 1-800-642-1234. Rick Kite is the director of the D.B. Reinhardt Institute for Ethics and Leadership at Viterbo University in La Crosse, also the host of the Ethical Life podcast. Let's go to Patty in Birchwood this morning. Patty, you're on the air.
Yes, good morning to you. Fascinating discussion. And I would like to ask the question, don't you think that before you can make decisions specifically in situations, that each individual has to have some kind of much broader foundation about what is the meaning of life? What is the meaning of death? What is the purpose that I'm here for? What is my relationship to the other? Are we all one, or are we all just individual? And then if you have some kind of foundation of what the meaning is, then you may be able to make those specific decisions a little easier. And of course, you have to live with those decisions, and they may, and your foundation might evolve over time. A lot of people get that foundation from religion, but we also see religion working the other way and causing a lot of harm in the world too. So I just would like to ask about the necessity of a bigger foundation working to the specific.
Patty, thank you. We've talked about having the facts, but what about having that foundation, a broader understanding of who we are and what we're doing here? Rick?
Yeah, I think it's very important. And this is one of the things that is very helpful, you know, as we get older, as we mature, is reflecting on and our life and what's the point of it, or what's the meaning of it, and then making sure that the way in which we live supports what we also find to be meaningful. So that's very important. I think most of us do have some sort of broader sense, whether it's fully articulated or not, and that just is expressed in a way through our character and through our choices. So whether we have a fully developed kind of reflective answer to say, what is the meaning of life, or what's the purpose of it all, we still live in such a way that we give an implicit answer to that kind of question, say by our consumer choices, by who we choose as friends, by all kinds of choices that we make in our daily lives. So the question is like, do we gradually develop a sense where our reflections on what is meaningful also are consistent with the way in which we actually live? And I think that's a really important project. That's a lot of what we do, say, when we're trying to teach ethics to young people, is to get them to reflect on how do their actual choices impact the way in which they see the world and interpret it.
Let's go to Todd in Appleton at 1-800-642-1234. Todd, you're on the air with Rick Kite.
Hey, good morning. Yes, I was wondering how big a concern the amount of censorship that we're experiencing in social media and in the major newspapers and news reporting is to your guest, and in terms of how people come to the point where they can make an honest and ethical decision about something. And I cite specifically the going into the Hunter Biden laptop issue, which the New York Times finally validated just last week in an article buried on page 20. But for months, or 16 or 18 months, that article was banned on social media. It was censored. The New York Times did everything they could to refute it without ever looking at any of the facts, and so did most of the other major media. There was no reporting on it prior to the 2020 election. And now about 17% of Biden voters have said that had they known about the Hunter Biden laptop and all the implications that lead up to Joe as a part of this, they would have voted differently, and that would have turned the entire election. But it has a lot of implications in other decisions that people make, too, especially when we just accept terms as misinformation. When something's labeled, we just come to accept things that social media platforms label as misinformation or lacking content or something like that, when it in fact turns out later to be correct.
Todd, we're running out of time. I want to get the answer here, but the New York Times last week did run the story about how the Justice Department's inquiry into the business dealings of the president's son has remained active, and a grand jury is continuing to seek information about payments from around the world. It starts with collecting all the facts, so how are we to wade through, and this goes back to whether or not it's even possible in a post-information age that all the facts would be available to us? How do we deal with things like censorship or how social media aggregates what we see? Rick?
Yeah, it's a big concern because I'm generally a very strong advocate of free speech, free press, you know, in general, because we have to be, it's so important for our democracy that we be able to get access to the information and then deliberate with one another about how we want to live our lives, what kind of laws we want, what kind of policies, who we elect, and so forth. But the issue, you know, with social media, it presents such a problem because we're developing more and more technology, more knowledge about how the brain works and how people can be deceived and manipulated. And this is always like used in such ways that the consequences of like deliberate use of misinformation are so much greater than they were in the past, just because our knowledge of how to use it to gain certain ends is always increasing. We look on a case-by-case basis. I think generally what we want is we want to support really responsible journalism that is open to lots of, say, conflicting information, but is also going to do some really investigative work on what's reliable and what's not. And then as individuals, what we want to do is get our news from a variety of sources, knowing that we maybe can't trust just one of them. I'm also concerned about the tendency towards self-censorship that we're seeing on many campuses right now, where university students are less reluctant to speak up about certain kind of controversial issues because of the potential shaming from their peers. And I've certainly seen this over the last couple of years in the classroom.
Rick Kite, very much appreciate the hour. Thank you for spending it with us this morning.
Thank you.
Rick Kite is the director of the D.B. Reinhardt Institute for Ethics and Leadership at Viterbo University in La Crosse. He's also the host of the Ethical Life podcast. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Kate Archer-Kent this morning, and you're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.